Blog Talk Radio.
This is Master Griot Radio, channel 13 on your NBBTA Internet Radio dial. I'm Jacqueline Taylor Adams, and I am your host for this moment in time. It's time for purpose-driven words, shaping thoughts, building minds, true wealth, communities, and legacies.
If my words had wings, they'd fly to you each day.
Youngest son, check it. Dear Willie, tell them we are rising up from the ashes of oppression, brushing the dust of poverty off the wings of this phoenix. Glory awaits my arrival. Briefly contemplate my history, the misery of my people's plight, the lynchings on the late night, injustice, miseducation, racist views, sensationalized news about black-on-black crime, crime-riddled neighborhoods, crying babies, dying babies. What's wrong with this scenario? Here we go, millions more marching, rising, reaching for new beginnings. It's within me. Take my hand, let me pull you up this ladder, the stairway to heaven. Please believe me, we gon' make it. Back from all the bullshit the bull whip that once beat the back of blacks now gives me strength. And this is my declaration, I am rising. And the last thing I'll let you do is break me. Humbled by circumstance, meek has been the position of my placement. I hail from the basement of America, and somehow this has come home to hell. Help me change this. Rise with me, build with me. Holler if you're feeling me. Tell them we are rising, and there's nothing they can do about it. My mother's name is Nature, and she deems it necessary for us to come back home and kneel at the throne of our father. His nickname is God. My brothers call him Allah, Elohim, Yahweh, Jehoshaphat, Hosanna, Jehovah God, the Alpha and Omega. He walked the earth in a shell called Jesus. He placed Muhammad on the mountain and told the wind to come down and put the surge in the waters of Zimzim. But somehow things are going a little too far before our Lord's done already told all we're coming. And now we're off and running, and I'm bringing a whole gang of positive people with me. Ghetto child, you're beautiful. Never think less or accept less or give anything less than your best at everything. Rise above life's pitfalls, all of y'all. Keep going, keep moving, keep striving, keep rising. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. You've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, run amok, let them stray. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Betty, son, we rising. What you thought we was gonna stay asleep? The force of the nation has awakened the spiritual beast. The lion and Judah roars, the falcon soars. We taking food for thought out the panther's jaws. For 400 years we've been integrated to a burning house. Now the Oval Office on fire. The poetic messengers throwing gas on the flame. Told y'all we gonna change the game. We rising. The church is recommitted to doing God's work. Open the doors to the jails, release the prisoner wars to the streets. Evacuate the class, the children are marching and dying. Hear that? Conscience shots are firing. No more lying, no more dying. You imperialistic devil got fat when my people starved. We want in. This is more than poetic music. I got a revolutionary heart and ain't scared to use it. By any means necessary, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. But please, God, use it as a sword to cut the head off the devil and his angels. King, it's time to atone. Take back your soul, your children at stake. Queen, clean up your home. From slave plantation, segregation, a crack crippled a nation, and black on black crime is just dumb. And through all this, how could Jesus Christ still not come? But the streets is beating the drum from his Betty's son. And I never lost a fight. My life, if I did, it was fixed. But they gotta come through sight if you wanna get through Chris. We true life lyricists. See, this ain't hip-hop, R&B, or poetry. This is word art, paint pictures from God. And it's easy as breathing when I'm flowing it. Last week just met, you already know where this is going. Say the children, say the streets. Black kids, follow me, drop signs. God in me, black light, poetry, black love. You know it's me. We got wings, we flying, we glow, we shining. Today, tomorrow, be rising.
All right, this is Master Griot Radio with a special edition. This is part two with our special guest, Bruce George, co-founder of Deaf Poetry Jam, and Luis Reyes Rivera, who is
a professor of African, African-American, Puerto Rican, and Caribbean literature and history, and they both are co-editors of The Bandana Republic, a literary anthology by gang members and their affiliates. And both of these brothers are on the line, so welcome.
Good day, good day. How are you?
All right. I'm right here.
Okay, okay. So, let's just take a moment and each of you introduce yourselves, introduce
okay.
yourselves to the audience. Lewis, would you like to introduce yourself first?
Well, is that because of my age?
I was going to say age before beauty. Go ahead.
That's that stuff now. Yeah, Lewis Reyes Rivera. I'm a poet, and I'm called the janitor of history. I've studied the living daylights out of it, and I teach it.
All right.
Right, right. And I'm Bruce George, and I'm the co-founder of the Bandana Republic, co-founder of Def Poetry Jam, and I'm an activist, poet, writer, you name it, grandfather, you know, child of God, the whole nine. And I'm blessed to be here, and we really appreciate you having us.
Okay.
Let's go.
Great. Well, this is a special edition. We did part one, got a little confused with 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. This is our late night edition, so our late night crowd, they're going to get an opportunity to hear about the Bandana Republic. So what inspired you, you know, how did it come about? You know, whose idea
right.
was it first, and then what inspired the other one to come along?
Right. Well, basically, it was an idea that I was blessed to come up with in terms of the fact that Lewis and I both know that when you talk about, you know, literature or you talk about art, we know that some of the best art, some of the best literature comes out of prison. Some of the best art, some of the best literature comes from the streets. And so, you know, it made perfect sense for us to get into and engage a project such as the Bandana Republic, because it enables these brothers and sisters that are in these street organizations or street tribes to be able to express themselves by way of poetry, prose, short stories, quotes, you name it. And so, you know, this book is a testament of the fact that they have something to say and they have something that is of relevance, and they are relevant.
And there's an art to it.
Okay.
That there is an art to it, that they're giving voice to their voice according to the, in many cases, the highest forms, quote-unquote, of artistic expression. This is not a book of confessionals. It's
exactly.
a straight-up grappling with the conditions and doing so within the parameters of literature.
Exactly. You know, I tell you, you know, Franz Fanon in The Wretched of the Earth said it best. He said, a national culture under colonial domination is a contested culture whose destruction is sought in systematic fashion. It very quickly becomes a culture condemned or condemned to secrecy. And so when you look at gang culture, you know, it is a defensive culture. You know, Lewis taught me to focus on the social conditions behind things or phenomena such as gang culture or what have you. You always have to look at the social condition. So, you know, and I talked about in the earlier segment that you notice the spin that is put on gang violence, whereas gang violence constitutes 1%, whereas domestic violence constitutes 15-16%. Why aren't there a lot of PSAs about, you know, anti-domestic violence?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, the people put spins or put a spin on something for a reason.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. I'm finished.
Yeah. So what were you saying, Bruce?
No, I'm finished. I finished my statement.
All righty. Well, how did you get, I mean, how many contributors are there to the book?
Roughly about 125 people from all over the country and outside the borders of the United States. There's a few of them. One from Australia, one from England, on death row. Is that right, Bruce?
Exactly, exactly. That's Reginald Sinclair, and I read his poem earlier.
Right. And from so from New York straight through to Los Angeles and San Francisco. There's somebody in there from every region of the United States. They all willingly and gladfully participated in this and submitted their work. And out of the stuff that we accepted comes a most interesting document that testifies to the potential that we all have and can realize artistically and as well as, quote, intellectually and spiritually. There's a it goes against every form that's previously been the kind of literature about gangs. There's no confessionals. There's no born-agains in there. There's no priest trying to tend to his flock.
Exactly.
It's straight up folks who in various ways have realized themselves and gone beyond the stereotypes that are often placed upon them. Included in the book, you might be interested, one of the, probably one of the last writings created by Oscar Brown Jr., the jazz singer.
They're great, that's right.
As well, there's a poem in there from Ruby Dee, the actress.
Exactly.
She came up in Harlem.
We have one from Fred Hampton Jr. as well as Malik Yoba from New York Undercover.
Yeah. So it's across the board and it's across the generations.
That's right.
Like that.
So when you look at literature historically, you know, like the Black Panther Party said, art is an indispensable tool of revolutionary struggle. Mahalia Jackson said, as I said earlier in the first segment, that she said when she was being interviewed by the Times, she said, what we have is trial and tribulation music. You know, there is a Russian poet by the name of Yevgeny Yevtushenko.
Yevtushenko.
Exactly. He said that great literature is always a great warning. You know, in other words, great literature is always a warning. You know, and Lewis talked about the notion that, you know, the poet is the cajoler of history. The poet is the flamethrower. The poet is the truth bearer. You know, and like Mumia said, the state would rather be have a Uzi than a microphone. So what's beautiful about this platform that Lewis and I were blessed to be a part of is the fact that, you know, we have created a platform where people can express themselves therapeutically, because there's a therapeutic element to it, and artistically, because there's an artistic element to it. You know, there's no pre-scripted soliloquies, you know, like Lewis alluded to. This is just straight from the gut, you know. And, you know, Bone, who was an Athens Park blood, who had he directed his directorial debut was Bastards of the Party on HBO. He submitted a piece, a quote, where he said, gangbanging is not a lifestyle, it's a death style. Gang leaders have told myself, I mean, from different sets, Crips, Bloods, Kings, you name it, that they're going to make this book required reading for their soldiers. I mean, I flew to the moon spiritually as a result of that. You know, so again, great literature is always a great warning. You know, and that's the bottom line.
Okay. So, just still for a little background and all, how did you and Lewis connect? It was your idea. You got 125 contributors. How did you and Lewis connect on a project?
Well, we were connected. We go back some years. We were a part of Bummer's the Page. Lewis was one of the editors of that book and authors of that book, along with Dr. Tony Medina. He's a doctor now. And so we connected even prior to that. I've always had a love and admiration for this brother because of his active activism, and just his knowledge. You know, when he talked about the notion that he's the janitor of history, I mean, he really, 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 really is very muckraking, which is an old nomenclature, I know. He's just very, very thorough with it, and a mentor. He's a mentor to me, and he inspires me to take myself to the next level in terms of history and just being able to put things in perspective. So we've had history, and a great history, and it was good because there's this intergenerational thing going on between Lewis and I, and then also we kind of like offset each other, sort of like on some Batman Robin type shit, you know? And so it works out well, and that doesn't happen often. But when it does happen, it's a real good thing. And so what we're doing is basically just riding the wave, you know. And Lewis comes out of gang culture. I come out of gang culture. You know, Lewis was a chaplain. You know, I was down with the Chaos Crew. I was a 5%er for a minute. I was down with the Uptown Zulu Nation out of Edenwall Project, so I know Bambaataa personally, you know. And I'm an old-school hip-hop head. You know, we used to borrow records from Bam when he was living in Baychester Projects. You know, and as I was saying earlier, you know, now everybody's a rap journalist and everybody's real, you know, an authoritative figure on it. But for us, it wasn't about being so technical and the whole nine. You know, this art form was created from scratch. You know, it was created like gumbo. Like, you know, it was just an amalgamation of just, you know, different things. It was created, like I always say, and I don't mean to be hackneyed about it, you know, but it was created out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't rocket science for us. You know, we improvise. And when you look at the notion of improvisation, that is a part of our culture. You know, it's a part of our culture to be able to weave and move and improvisation. So when you talk about the jazz artists, you talk about, you know, when you talk about old Negro spirituals, you know, improvisation is a part of our black vernacular. And rooted within that is an element of survival. That's why our dialects change. That's why our, you know, so-called slang or what have you constantly changes from generation to generation. It's rooted in survival.
Mm-hmm. So what about you, Lewis? What got you, what inspired you to be on a project?
Well, I've always been about the business of encouraging more literature. I've been teaching or training writers since 1969. And for me, every opportunity to advance our literature is a responsibility, not just an opportunity. I come from that era where we didn't have, quote, black studies departments, Puerto Rican studies departments, a real genuine planetary studies, right? You know, there are 6.2 billion people on the planet. 1.2 billion come from China alone, 800 million come from Indonesia, and another billion come out of India. Now, that's three countries with half the world's population, and we don't know nothing about them.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's the same thing here when I was coming up. We didn't know anything about ourselves. So I was part of that new heat, if you will, back in the late 60s that got an opportunity to go to college and used that opportunity to open up more doors. As a result, I was one of them folks that helped to establish Black Studies Department, a Puerto Rican Studies Department, and an Asian Studies Department here in New York that affected the entire state and eventually the entire country. Somebody, you know, you had to have something, some kind of course at least, if not three courses, on those people. And the thing is that we're always left with having to discover ourselves all over again. And so that not only in my work as a poet, but as well as one of the people out here, every opportunity I get to help encourage more folks to have their work in print allows for more growth and legitimization, quote unquote, of our literature, our being, our contribution to this now, you know. And so when Bruce came up with the idea and says, yo, man, what do you think of this? And I says, you round up the talent, I'll do the editing. And we worked it out, and took us 3 years to find a publisher willing to take it on, but we kept chiseling at it anyway until
exactly.
Here it is.
That's how important this project was to us. You know, that when we received resistance, that was a good thing. Because it was just letting us know that much more that we had some heat, you know. And, you know, Dr. King said it best, what affects one directly affects another indirectly. The jailer is doing time right along with the jail.
Yes, sir.
You know? And that's real. And so the bottom line is we as a society have to get out of this mentality that I'm better than you, or I'm because I have a certain skin color that I have privilege. And, you know, I mean, you see it in art where you have the critic, and I talked about this earlier. The critic is the gatekeeper to the state, who is the gatekeeper to the ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's the fashion critic, whether it's the critic in literature, their goal is to keep us, to keep our voices out of the rational discourse, you know. And so that's why I love a quote by Eugene V. Debs, who's a socialist. He said, while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. And while there is a soul in jail, I am not free. That's why I share that socialistic ideology. You know, I share that wholeheartedly. You know, and that's real for me.
Yeah, well, it's not too much to get shot or to be jailed. At all.
Exactly.
And that's one of the themes that comes out. You know, the interesting thing here is that the book, The Bandana Republic, has 125 people, the overwhelming majority of them one another.
Excuse me, gentlemen, just real quick. I mean, I want you to carry on, but I had someone with a physical emergency right now, so you guys just carry on a discussion.
Okay, we'll do.
Okay? All right.
Okay, and I hope everything turns out well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, you know, the bottom line is, you know, when you talk about literature or you talk about culture, it's contested, you know, and the bottom line is the same thing with the music industry. You know, I had written a quote where I said the music industry historically has had a faulty moral compass. The artist is an objectification of cookie-cutter marketing schemes laced with widget assembly line boilerplate economics. This fuzzy math intrinsically sharecrops the artist into fame without fortune. So, Lewis, I know you know exactly what I'm talking about in reference to that.
Is that one of the poems in the book?
I don't even know if I put that in there. I know it was just a quote I had gotten pissed off the music industry in terms of how they sharecrop artists, and people have this misconception that just because they see them in the videos and because they see them, you know, blinged out or whatever, you know, that's the perception, and the perception is reality for a lot of people. But the real deal is that's not what's really going down.
Yeah,
you know, and right. But we're to the listeners, we're very excited about this book. It was a long time coming, and what this book is going to do is going to further extend the shelf life of poetry,
And it's going to also, you know, it's just going to go down in the annals of history, because this book has never, ever been done before. When you talk about gang literature, you know, usually it's biographical or autobiographical in nature. And even the ones that remotely resemble an anthology, usually it talks about one or two gangs. And that's the deal. So this is a history-making book. We advise the audience to go out and definitely support it. Part of the proceeds from the book is going to AmeriCAN Illinois, and as well as AmeriCAN in LA with Jim Brown. That's Jim Brown's organization. He had founded that. He's one of the founder of that organization, and that organization is built upon a 10-point system, platform system, where these individuals go into it, these gang members go into it, and they learn how to get matriculated back into society or assimilated back into society. And so we definitely would like for you guys to support this book. You can go to softskull.com. I know I got the New York accent, so it's soft, S-O-F-T, skull, S-K-U-L-L.com. Or you can go to the Bandana Republic's MySpace page and get a load of that. You can go to MySpace, www.myspace.com/TheBandanaRepublic. And the way we're spelling it is the, T-H-E, Bandana, B-A-N-D-A-N-A, Republic, R-E-P-U-B-L-I-C. So you can definitely check that out and then take it from there.
And the folks should also know that the book is not just poetry.
Exactly.
There are letters, interviews, short stories, essays, and proclamations.
Exactly.
Into poetry.
Exactly. Lewis, do you have the book with you? Because if you would read a piece of your introduction, specifically the part that you talked about in reference to thugs, because that's the word.
Thug, all right.
Exactly. That part in terms of the etymology of the word thug and how you had broken it down historically.
Right.
That was definitely on point.
Pulling it out right now.
Okay.
And,
no, so again, you know, to the audience, we're excited.
This is a short excerpt from the introduction to the book, The Bandana Republic. Thug, you should know, is an ancient Hindu word first used to describe a group of religious fanatics who, quote, murdered and robbed on behalf of Kali, a goddess of destruction, unquote. Here in the Americas, it manifested itself somewhere as late as 1493, the year Columbus brought 1,500 Spaniards to Hispaniola with the intention of conquering and enslaving the natives there. The thugs Columbus brought with him came in the form of bounty hunters with hound dogs to help recapture runaway slaves. Thus, the following words entered into our dictionaries: Cimarron, Maroon, Buccaneer, Outlier, Quilombo. Those first bounty hunters laid the foundation for what we today call policemen. Needful to say, our relationship to them has not changed in 500 years. Unquote. End of the excerpt.
Exactly. And you know, what's so deep about what you just said is the fact that we want this book to really dispel a lot of myths about, you know, gang violence and gang culture, gang culture in general. You know, and it's like, you know, what's interesting is the fact that Mayor Daley, or Chicago was in the game. Okay, but because of his skin privilege, he tracked from a gang into politics. And there were a lot of people, because of their skin privilege, who tracked from gangs into the fire department, from gangs into the police department, from gangs into politics, or gangs into unions. You know, and whereas those individuals that weren't as privileged, we were caught up within our neighborhoods. You know, Dr. Kenneth B. Clark had written a book called Dark Ghettos, and he talked about the notion that the ghetto serves a dual purpose. One part of it is those individuals that are in the so-called ghetto, which is a term or a nomenclature from Germany, right? It serves the purpose of those individuals keeping them down. In other words, whoever is the strongest will survive, and they will keep those underneath them down, through whether it's through drug selling or robbery or what have you. And then the other purpose that it serves is it keeps us marginalized from the opulent or the wealthy, you know. And so that's my take on that. And what I would like to do is to, I feel like, when I said that, like Mr. Rogers, you know, what I would like to do at this juncture, are you back, Jacqueline?
Yes, back.
Is everything okay?
Well, it's monitored, yeah, my mom's heart. So we got her medicine, and so
okay, she's okay, okay.
Her.
Okay,
but
well,
right
we're
now,
definitely praying for her.
Thank you,
okay.
Thank you.
Yes. Sure.
Well, we have a caller on the line, someone from 973.
Okay,
hello.
Hey, how y'all doing? This is Clarence, Coach, Mr. and Friend. How you feeling today?
Hey, how are you, Clarence?
Thanks
for joining.
Well, you know, I was just going through my Craigslist posting, and I saw your email, and I said, oh, yeah, can't miss Jackie's show.
I heard that.
Okay.
Well, thanks for calling in, without a doubt.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, it's really, really, it's good to try to put a positive spin on a negative situation. When I was younger, I was involved with gang activities. However, we weren't really a gang, you know. Basically, we were just a group of friends who hung out, although the people we did hang around, people who were actually in some of the more active gangs in the city of Newark at that time, and I did have to leave the city of Newark for a particular point in time. But, you know, it's difficult to actually, how can I say, justify, all right, gang existence, especially when you are looking at some of the activity that's going on and how some of the gangs are playing roles in terrorizing our youth, all right, in terms of forcing them to participate in their activity when they don't want to. And like, basically, it's really something in terms of the gang mentality. Gangs have been around for a very, very long time. There was a book on Fez, the story of Fez, which is a country in Morocco. And basically what they were talking about was young groups of Muslims and Christians would run around in gangs, you know, terrorizing the community. If you look at Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, basically what you had were two gangs. That's where they came up with the concept of West Side Story. And I don't know if you said the Maroons were the police officer, but the Maroons...
No.
Oh, no.
Yes,
we didn't say that.
Play.
The Bounty Hunters.
The bounty hunters
were the ones who served as the basis for what we call police.
Oh, okay. The bounty hunters who were looking for the Maroons.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what, to make sure that we weren't confusing the Maroons with the police.
Oh, no. Well, Well, you see, the thing is that I give up the word. If you're familiar with the word, then we're on the same page. If you're not, you can go to the dictionary, look it up, and lo and behold, there goes a history for you. Cimarron is a word that was used to mean wild animal, and that was used by the Spaniards as a way of describing their animals who ran away. Included among those that they considered animals were the ones that they imported or had imported into the Americas, or who lived in the Americas and were conquered by the Spaniards, right? In other words, the human beings who had been turned into slaves by the Spaniards, both African and Amerindian, and they were not considered any greater than the cow or the pig that also ran away. And so they were all called Cimarrons. And from that word comes the word maroon, which means to say he who runs away, or he who resists slavery. I don't believe that the Bandana Republic tries to justify in a positive way a negative condition.
Exactly.
I don't believe that that's what we do, and I would certainly urge you to go read the book in its entirety. What we're doing is laying out exactly what it all looks like, including the politics of it, the economics of it, and how many have to spend a number of years going through a whole bunch of changes before they latch on to that thing, that river, that says, wait a minute, I've been going the wrong way, right? Now, a lot of that is in the book as well. Crips and Bloods are in there, and both of them claim that they began their history wanting to defend their communities.
That's right.
Right? And both the Crips and the Bloods that are represented in that book, both of them are saying that they urge the young Crips and the young Bloods to come back to their original mission instead of that negative stuff that they be doing, vis-a-vis the drugs and the guns and do.
But I think you mentioned yourself, all right.
I come out of a gang experience, yes, very much so, from the 50s and 60s.
I was talking about.
I'm not ashamed of that. I think that helped me to understand the country I lived in better.
Exactly.
You know, every one of those examples that you gave up in terms of people throughout the different parts of the planet who have been involved in stuff like this, you'll find that they all have one common thread. They suffered hunger behind the fact that somebody else was grabbing it all.
Exactly. Always.
And
always.
That always manifests itself in people needing to defend themselves. And as you know with sports, the best defense is a good offense. So you take on that posture. But you got to look at the social conditions that led to your hunger and then that led to you thinking that this is the way to do it.
Exactly.
Okay, one moment, gentlemen. We have another caller on the line from 951. Hello? Hello? Caller from 951.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, this is Edwina calling from California. How you guys doing? I am listening to the radio show. I know Jacqueline, and I usually don't call radio shows and talk to him because I'm not a great orator, but I will say this. I'm a correctional officer, and I do believe that sometimes there is a fine line in between. I'm at work right now, as a matter of fact, that there is a fine line between the correctional officer and the inmate, and we have to be careful that we don't put ourselves in a position to feel like we're superior. Me being a black woman, unfortunately, what black person do we know that doesn't have somebody in their family that either close or distant that has been incarcerated. So I
That's
do try
right.
to make myself treat these young men, and I work for the Youth Authority actually, treat these young men as I would want one of my family members, and specifically my nephew, to be treated in the prison that he's in. So we have to be really, really careful. I do know that sometimes these young men come from situations that puts them in the position to be destined to be in gangs and do horrible things. But then they're in here, and you can hold a decent conversation with them. And sometimes you can't even hardly believe some of the crimes that they committed because of the type of conversations that you have with them.
Exactly.
We have a college program. Laverne University teaches a college program up here. And I have seen some of the people have done some of the heinous crimes that you ever could believe. Go get a college education. I don't have a college education. And go to USC or go to UCLA and get a college education. So I know that if they get the support that they need, that they can grow. And
wonderful.
They can.
I want to thank you for that.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I want to thank you for coming on.
But criminality has nothing to do with education. Some of the biggest criminals who exist right now are some of the most highly educated people in our society, a.k.a. members of our government, federal government, you know, and the crimes which they perpetrate against the people.
No, just for a second. I'm comfortably past 60, let's say. I have yet to run into an infant just born wanting to hate and destroy. Now, there's something that happens between that baby's birth and maturation into getting past puberty. There's something that happens between that period that makes such an endearing and loving child someone that we have a problem with, even to the point where the parent is afraid of his own child.
Exactly.
Now, those things we need to look at for what they are. And that's part of what the Bandana Republic attempts to do, even though it did it by default. Those 125 people in that book don't know one another. And yet, when you read the entire book from cover to cover, you see the condition and the response, both political, intellectual, as well as economic and spiritual. You'd be surprised how many folks in there, there are several, who tried to chase you to God. And that's something that you were hinting at earlier. That, yes, education is not the answer by itself. There's got to be a moral ethic attached to what you do. But you learn that anyway yourself, right? Because that's how you began, that infant wanting to be held and fed. And if that infant don't get held and fed correctly, that infant is going to grow up responding to the fact that he, she didn't get what they had earned just by virtue of their birth.
That's right. And when you talk about, that's what I said from the very beginning, that gang culture is a defensive culture. You know, and, you know, gang violence is a symptom of the problem. But they will spin it as though it is the problem. You know, I mean, Dante said it best. He said the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. So you're just as guilty if you're in a position where you can do something about it and you don't do anything about it. It's not about writing a check to the United Negro College Fund once a year and sitting back and patting yourself, you know, in Beverly Hills and saying, yeah, I'm all good. I give back to the community. No, it's not about that. And it's about taking, and to the preachers out there, ministers, it's about, listen, going, taking it to the street, taking your ministry out of that church and taking it to the street where you can speak to the youth directly, where you can provide jobs for them within the church directly. You know, and that's what it's all about. So when you talk about gang violence, it's a symptom of the problem. It is not the ultimate problem.
And what the ultimate problem is if we want to get real political, is capitalism. Okay, the primary goal, like Noam Chomsky said, we don't have a democracy. What we have is a polyarchy in which the system is a system in which the power resides in the hands of the wealthy, the minority, that the minority opulent taking over the majority, lumping proletariat or the poor or the underclass. You know, it's a class system and a caste system struggle.
I like to make a point here right now. I just like to say, and it's proven, it's this Philadelphia, we are being, I mean, violence is so on the rise. Gang violence is coming back. The Crips have actually come back in. They're recruiting, and young people are running to them. I work with the House of Umoja.
Mm-hmm.
It's a residential home for boys, African-American males, primarily ages 15 to 19. Now, how they get to the House of Umoja is from truancy, because, mm-hmm. you know, they understand that truancy is a symptom of a major problem.
Right,
and
exactly.
So now they come for truancy. They come generally only supposed to be maybe a 30-day stay. This is after, you know, someone has continuously been truant. They went to court, they had corrective action, their normal ways haven't happened. Now, when we find out, we get there, most of them boys, instead of being there 30 days, most of them, they age out. They just wind up living there, go to college, and they basically age out the system because we're finding out there's no home structure.
Yes.
They don't have support. So how they got caught was just by being truant to school. But when we go, because I, you know, we also go into the schools and we provide safety services. The safety services mean you have to get to the root of the problem. If there's a fight going on in the school, when we develop the relationship by just speaking to the students. We make the parents and the whole community come up there on the first day of school and say hello to everyone as they go in. So those kids feel that people will talk to them. The people we put in the school is the safety people, people from the neighborhood, which allows us to know what's going on and have conversations. If a fight goes on in school, believe something done happened in the street.
Mm-hmm.
So you find out that this is a beef between so-and-so, so-and-so that has spilled over into the school. So you go to the homes. But you find out a lot of times they don't have a home. Or, you know,
yeah.
parents are on drugs. One boy, you know, he would wear the same thing over and over till it would stink all the time. But he was afraid if he take his clothes off, his mom would steal him. I mean, it's all these conditions so that brings these kids to this level. So, like, when they get to the House of Umoja, that's more, they pride themselves on being a family. Everybody calls Queen Mother Mom, and everybody calls Dave Pop. And even George has been up there. So it's like over 3,000, you know, men across the country, even people from Ireland that have been there, and they call them mom and pop. It's like a family environment. And we
mm-hmm.
find by giving them that family structure. That's how the whole House of Moses came about. She found out through a magazine story investigation about the gang violence in Philly that her son was in a gang. She couldn't find any help, so she asked her husband because she moved the gang into her home. So by them replacing a gang structure with a family structure, like 5-6 years later, they were able to actually end gang violence in Philly. And though the gangs never stopped because they're still organized, but the gang violence stopped because they were able to convince them it wasn't really in their best interest. Like the brothers are saying now, this is not reason why we formed in the first place. So they're trying to teach the younger people. When they understand whatever goals and all they want in life, it's not in their interest, and people take the time to show them and show them love and caring, they will make different choices. So, and we all
find out
the basis of this is economics. You
it
can't take
economic.
The economic equation
it is.
And think you're going to make a change. People got to eat.
They have to eat, and they're going to
yeah.
eat. And, you know, the thing that's so deep is, you know, I'm familiar with when the Bloods penetrated Philly. They first penetrated Philly, by the way, in northern Philly. And the way gang culture is set up is if you have a north, east, west, and south, if a gang, whatever gang penetrates the northern side. That's like putting a flag down. You're going to always have the opposite gang on the opposite side. So if the Bloods, if you have north and south, if the Bloods penetrate the north, you're going to have the Crips in the south. You know, and I don't mean to be tangential. I want to say this. Queen Mother Fatah is amazing. And Dave, you know, I just want to definitely, in terms of the House of Emojis, they've been doing so much for Philly and so much for the youth, the disenfranchised youth. I definitely need to shout them out and send love to them because, you know, they dedicated their lives, a big chunk of their lives, to really saving our youth, you know. But, you know, Alonzo out of L.A., he's a gang expert. And he drew a map in terms of the highest proliferation of gang violence, and it was in impoverished neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's an, you're right, there's an economic element to this. You know, now it's a problem because they penetrated the suburbs. That's when it becomes a problem. You know? This is crazy.
If I may, in regards to the economic, you know, I work for the Youth Authority, and so we are in to quote-unquote rehabilitation. And let me tell you, for each individual young man that is housed in the Youth Authority in California, we spend $100,000 a year housing them. Our recidivism rates are extremely high. So that means they're coming back. So there's a lot of problems with us spending that amount of money. But then when they leave here, they parole, they max out, whatever the case may be, they go back to the same situation that they're in. And, you know, a lot of us think that's so ironic because with $100,000, I could go to Yale.
Exactly.
I could move our entire family to a safer neighborhood or to a different neighborhood.
But this is the thing, all right? How are you talking about, all right, changing the associations? One of the reasons why you have 12-step programs have their high success rate is because one of their basic premises is change people, places, and things, all right? Mm-hmm. And that thing primarily being the person themselves and the way they think. Now, basically, if you could spend $1 million on a person, housing them, educating them, but if they're going to be thrust back and hang around with the same people and not actually have a support system of different people who they're open to associate with,
mm-hmm.
Same attitude, same actions. That's why people relapse.
If I may, for
you're
a
not
second,
taking a move like that, you take money to move and relocate.
You were mentioning the House of Umoja.
Umoja,
yes,
right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, and you also made mention that each of the individuals who are assigned as a result of court or what have you, they have to attend the House of Umoja.
Yes.
Or live there, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then you also said that the folks who run it are so endeared that they are called Mom and Pop.
Yes.
And that you have effectively replaced the street gang model that we refer to as negative with a family model, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the House of Umoja by itself is not enough. Imagine the individual not only being offered a family structure, but as well a communal structure when more and more folks do as Mom and Pop do, right?
And Lewis, that's part of their success is because that community is called Carroll Park. But because Queen Mother and them had lived there so long themselves, and I think even her parents, they've been part of that community. That's one of the few communities I see in Philly that still, even though it's changing, but it's still they gather together, and like the school
like
is the local school. So when
and we need to learn from that model, the House of Umoja, and import that to New York and Chicago and L.A. and et cetera. Right? What I'm suggesting
they want structure. They need structure.
Right. Well, yeah. What I'm suggesting is that in terms of what your friend from Newark was just saying, that we need to appreciate not only the potential that one model gives up, but how we end up also returning to a certain kind of African and Amerindian root. Communalism ruled in the Americas before the Europeans came here, just as it ruled in Africa before the European went there, right? And I'm saying the individual, that's the first layer, the family structure, that's the second, and the communal structure, that's the third. And there you get your sense of direction so that when you do graduate into adulthood, you don't return back. You know, you were saying they age out, right? But you don't return back to the thing that was destroying you, right? Because you have a better direction. And I'm saying that we need to learn more about places like the House of Umoja.
That's
and then
true.
We don't have to be talking about gangs. We'd be talking about
sure.
the next thing, ownership of our destiny, including the land we live on.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. You know, the people in gang culture, you know, it's like I said before, it's a defensive culture. You know, Assata Shakur said it best. He said, the only difference between prison and the streets is one is maximum security and the other is minimum security.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the bottom line is, you know, there's still oppression. There is still suppression. There is still, you know, and people, the human nature of a person is going to be to defend him or herself and to eat and to survive. And you're not going to take that away from people. What affects one directly, again, affects another indirectly, like Dr. King said. You know, so we need to know that we are all related. We need to know that, you know, there's no big I's and little U's. And we need to know that we're not free, like Eugene V. Debs said. You know, while there is a soul in prison, I am not free. So we really need to get off of this elitist BS.
Yeah, but some people need to be in prison because they're unpaid.
Right.
That's
what Richard Pryor said.
I would love to say that I hear what you're saying, all right, but in the indigenous population of this continent, you have warring communities. And prior to capitalism existing, you had gangs. And in fact,
yeah.
most of the nobles were
right.
gangs, and the more
yeah,
successful
yeah,
gangs
just,
the more
need to be in
and aristocracy.
Right, no, wait, just for a second now. There are people you know who need to be in prison. Just for a second now, please. The reason why we put out the Bandana Republic is because all of our people, every citizen in this country, needs to look at what that is. You want me to devote a lot of time and energy to imprison that fellow that needs to be in there instead of spending my time on that baby just born who
yeah.
needs my attention so that that child don't grow up to replace the one that you want me to imprison.
Exactly. Like the sister
no,
said.
No, we're not saying that at all.
We're talking about one that needs to be in prison. What about the ones that didn't deserve to be imprisoned? And what about the ones that are still out here and didn't get there yet?
And Karl Rove, they all need to be locked up.
Well, the thing which I'm getting to is that there are...
Christian Cheney, too.
Those babies who you're talking about protecting need to be protected from some of those hardcore elements, all right, who are being manipulated, all right, and some willingly being manipulated into
yes.
perpetuating the system and the violence. And you see, basically,
right.
some people, all right, basically are just hardcore. They're too damaged. For whatever reason, all right, to basically function in a society in a healthy manner, a productive
manner. Well, that's a deviation
manner.
Above the norm. What you're talking about is a deviation above
the
norm.
understand that there are certain people, because I've been in jail. I've been in jail, all right? I've seen people in jail, all right? So I'm talking about from my personal experience, and those people need that they're right where they're supposed to be. Because if let out, they are a threat to people who are trying to move forward and build productive lives.
But you know what, though, sir? They are a deviation above and below the norm. Normatively speaking, I don't agree with you. Normatively speaking, that is not the case, because the average person in prison is not in there for violent reasons. They're in there for nonviolent offenses, and that's a fact.
That's more than 65% of the people in prison are in there for nonviolent acts.
That's a fact. And the truth is incontrovertible. Malice may attack it, and ignorance may deride it, but in the end, there it is staring you right in your face.
I'm not denying
that.
I'm not.
One moment. Just let Lewis speak, please.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not denying that there are those who, like Richard Pryor said, well, I'm sure glad they got prisons, you know, when he was making that movie about being in prison, right? But what happens is you're only talking about some. And my problem is that you don't see any humanity in any of them, because they're all in jail. And I'm saying, you know, that's a very, very narrow way of looking at it, because it don't take nothing for you to land in jail. I've been working in jails on and off for more than 30 years, and I've worked in the court system. And the overwhelming majority of the people who are imprisoned have no business being locked up.
Period.
There are those, I agree with you. I grew up with some. Cut your throat in a minute, leave you right there. Don't mean nothing, you know. But I also saw their humanity, and I recognized that as something that is refused or neglected by everybody else. The fact of the matter is, you are not born wanting to give pain to another human being. Why can't we look at what it is that leads to me wanting to hurt someone physically?
Exactly. That's what gets overlooked.
Why can't we learn to look at that? I'm sorry.
Because
be willing to look at that.
And there's something mentally imbalanced in them. And unfortunately, because we have some people who are weak-willed, all right, they basically, it might not be weak-willed, it just might be fear of force, all right, causes them to get in situations what winds them up in jail. Poor judgment, you know. But then again, not having the proper protective, truly protective measures, all right, to nurture the community. Because when the gangs come, all right, and this is what basically
you just described.
About.
You just described what Bush and Cheney have been guilty of for the last 8 years.
Exactly.
Ain't nobody moved to arrest them or imprison either one of them.
Well, that's the number one gangster, Lewis. Don't you know Bush is the number one?
That's what I'm saying. You know, I mean, that was one of the first things I said. You know, I mean, the people who are running the country are some of the biggest criminals. The whole Noriega conspiracy. See, the Crips and Bloods aren't importing the drugs. They aren't growing the drugs in Colombia.
Exactly.
Right. The drugs are being supplied by somebody. The guns aren't being manufactured by the Crips and the Bloods. All right. They are being used as tools. I admit that. All right. And I understand that. The question is how do we as a community provide a safe environment where we can actually interact and keep our children from being forced down a path which offers no good?
Well, okay, that's a good question. Now, check this out. My name is not Bill Cosby. I'm not going to stop at simply saying the parents need to get involved and raise their children. That's not the only thing that needs to happen. The community as a whole needs to learn to control the precincts that preside over their communities. As long as the police precinct is not under the direct control of the community that it patrols, right, then what you have is the criminalization of the poor. Now, that's the second thing that needs to happen besides the parents, right? The third thing that needs to happen is that we need to stop being stupid when it comes to the people that we elect and vote into office to write laws that conduct that guide the conduct of business. We're supposed to not just elect someone, but look among our own and nurture our voices to help write those laws that govern how we conduct business. And that's what all of this is about. We need to learn how to teach our children in every school about everything that happened before yesterday, everywhere, affecting every people. Otherwise, they will not understand the range of humanity that we all are. And so that, you know, I'm not going to get into a thing which you are saying, yeah, well, the thing to do is the parents need to get up off their behind. Yeah, that's true. But the community has to have a much clearer direction if it wants its youth to be clearer and cleaner about what they do.
That's right.
Okay. Gentlemen, this has been really wonderful, wonderful dialogue. I just like to take a moment here. This is just my personal mission right now at this point in time in life. Everything you're saying, Lewis, is exactly correct.
Thank you.
And it's been proven. I mean, he's not, you know, not because he's super intelligent or anything. These have been proven strategies that work. But I'd like to say for the person that may seem overwhelming to, and somebody wants to say, what can I do? The first thing we can all do is start being community. And that means don't walk out your home and don't walk past anyone and not just say hello.
Wonderful.
Do, and we walk past young black men and don't speak, and young girls, I don't care what they're saying out their mouth, how they're saying. But when you just don't acknowledge a person as a human being,
there you go.
That they're human.
That's a very, very good point.
And then you talk about their behavior, how they act as animals, but how are you treating them?
Right.
So, you know, that's the first thing you can do is just say hello without expectation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't expect them to change. Don't expect them to be wonderful. They may cuss you out. They may whatever. But you say hello. And then stop being afraid. Can't no one take your time? God dictates our time when we come and when we go. No one can take that away from you. So stop walking in fear and stop being afraid of our own children.
No,
and
no.
Our children.
I
if you see someone doing something wrong, say something. They might cuss you out. Oh, well, they still wrong. So you know you're wrong. I hear you. You know you're wrong. Keep going on about your business. But
what
it will, over
point,
the long
right?
haul, make a difference.
Yes, ma'am, you're absolutely correct, because the moment that you tell me that I made a serious error, that I blew it, right, even if I chastise you for telling me that, I still got to go home and think about what you said.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah, so we don't know at what point in time it may, but it is proven that we forget nothing. Everything is lodged somewhere in our memory, and something will come back. But it's the community responsibility. We can't keep talking about everybody else and keep talking about those people. They're our people.
Wonderful.
They're our family members, and we're responsible. No one asks to be born. They come into a world, into an environment that the people before them created. So, I mean, we can't stop taking responsibility for the condition of this world and blaming others. You know, so, and you would be surprised. Our reality, our personal realities is not everyone's reality. You would be surprised some of the conditions that people come up under, and you wonder how they even survived that far. If it wasn't
yet,
the defense mechanism.
And you made a very good point, I have yet to say what's up to somebody and not get, like some type of love back. I have yet. And even though some people will scratch their head or whatever, I have yet to do that. And I remember when I was with the Black Panther Collective in Harlem, right, a part of my leadership made a very good point because we used to have meetings and political education classes, and I remember Dead Prez, the rap group Dead Prez, we used to go to the Armory, and they used to have these political education classes as well. And a part of my leadership was saying, you know what, you know, there's certain members that are not even getting to the, you know, they're not even on time. So what you're talking about is internal revolution, external revolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to have that internal revolution first. You know,
yeah.
So it starts with the man in the mirror. It starts with the woman in the mirror, and you're absolutely right. We got to stop walking past each other. We got to stop mean mugging each other. You know, we have to break through that ice. You know, because you'd be surprised. That person that you say hi to could be the person that'll save your damn life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and please let me add this one more to everything both of y'all just got through saying.
Mm-hmm.
If we can eat or look forward to eating 3 and 4 times a day and there satisfy our physical needs, then how come we don't read 3 and 4 times a day outside of what we're told to read? Right,
sure.
So that we can feed our brains in the same manner that we feed ourselves with the food.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's true. And there's so much you can do on that. And I have found that I have 3 grandchildren by one of my stepdaughters. I actually have about 11 of them all together. But one of my stepdaughters who unfortunately was killed, shot in the head.
My condolences.
So her children, they had 2 different fathers in the sets, and I found there was a big difference in culture, just how we were raised.
Yeah.
And so my stepdaughter, she wasn't the easiest girl to deal with. She had her issues, but she was an avid reader. And my sister-in-law, you know, she did arts and crafts. So we'd sit down and had times where we'd make stuff with the children. From the time they were in the belly, somebody around is going to read to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I sold books, so that was my gift to every child and anywhere near me. You got books, but her other 2 children who had a different father, that family had a different culture. They didn't read. You know, reading wasn't just like, you know, I have bookcases of books. I didn't even realize that my grandson, her oldest one that stayed with us, he has a whole bookcase full of books. He's collected all the books he got. That's just part of our life from infancy. But they didn't get the same thing because that's not part of their culture. They don't just read. They don't just read, too. But and then all of these kind of things go to, we don't think about these things, but when you're complaining and not thinking, and it's summertime and you're just sitting out and kids are hanging around, sit down and take out a book and read. All of them may not hang around, but 1 or 2 are going to sit around and listen to you read to them. There are some of the best stories just written. And, you know, those are things we could do. We have so many adults that can't read that would appreciate it if you just be open enough.
Yes.
But we don't share this culture. You need to share it or let somebody see you reading. We just take that for granted. And it wasn't really until I had, you know, my grandchildren that I helped out, and I had to deal with all of these different families, you know, in order to raise them, that I realized things we took for granted.
You
know, my stepdaughter, she never finished the 9th grade, but she got a GED. But that's because she was an avid reader. She ate up books and almost all of my books. I probably don't know where half of them are now. But
she was probably being mistaught in school anyway.
Yeah, our school systems are terrible. There's so much for us to work on. But if we don't take concern and look at each other as human beings,
That's right.
And realize that we're connected to one another, then we keep saying it's their problem. Look at that school, the school, but all we have to do is rally around and get around that school and demand certain type of education.
That's right.
You know, if it's your school, it's a public school, your tax dollars are paying, you should have some idea what's going on in that school, whether your child goes there or not.
Yeah.
We have to just take that tone and mentality. So from that, I like to mention, since we're here, and this is about the Bandana Republic, for those of who are still listening in, we need you to take ownership. Again, everybody will know another one of my big bandwagons is, and you can go to my website at mastergrio.com, we need to own our art. We do not own our own art forms, therefore we don't own our voice. And then that's why hip-hop can move from what African Bambaataa started to the state it's in today. Because we don't own our art forms.
Right, that's a very good point.
This is a historical book. This has never been done before. These are voices that have never been heard from in this manner. And it's our art. We need to own it. So we just need to buy it up. So all of these anti-violence organizations, peace organizations.
There you go.
You can't get there if you don't understand the mindset and the culture. You can't teach from a culture that you don't know or understand.
And the book is very instructional. Anybody can use it as a teaching tool.
That's right.
And so
anybody.
We have a special discount for our teachers, for our organizations. If you want to purchase anywhere between 5 and 23 books, you're going to get an exclusive 25% discount. If you want to purchase a case or more, 24 or more, we're going to give you a 50% discount. So there's, like, no reason, and nowhere else would you be able to get this volume discount, even if you went straight to the publisher. No one's going to give you this volume of a discount. So we ask that you please, you know, take it, use it as an instructional tool. You know, engage some literature that your youth would really like and absorb and teach them through that people that they see every day and people just like them, you know, their excellence in writing, and teach them iambic pentameters and about prose, and, you know, let these be lessons learned. They'll definitely absorb it.
Exactly.
And so,
do you want
Bruce,
me to give that number out?
Do you let them know how can they get the book?
Yeah, what you can do if you're going to buy them in bulk, the name of the company is Perseus Audit Department, and the number is 1-800-343-4499. Again, that's 1-800-343-4499. And mention that you heard about this through the Master Griot Project, and as well as the editors of the Bandana Republic.
Okay. And were you going to say something else, Bruce?
No, I just wanted to say that, put that out there.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you very much for allowing us this space.
Yeah, thank you for allowing us this platform. And just being just so diligent, you know, in terms of just creating a platform for people to not only to express themselves, but to also learn and to grow, you know. And I want to thank all of the callers that called, because, you know, I mean, everything they said was very relevant and relative.
Yes.
And the listeners. We want to thank you for taking the time out, you know, to listen.
To put up with us.
Part of the show. Exactly. It got a little heated, but it's all good. It's the way it's supposed to be. It's about dialogue.
Yes.
Yes.
I hope so.
Exactly.
Now, the book you can purchase the Bandana book anywhere. It's available in all stores, all major stores, from Walden to Borders, Amazon. You can get it at Amazon online. Isn't there a page for it, too, on MySpace?
Yeah, we have a MySpace. You can go to, first you can start with the publisher's page, is www.soft.com. Then we have the MySpace page to the Bandana Republic. It's myspace.com/ the, T-H-E, bandana, B-A-N-D-A-N-A, Republic, R-E-P-U-B-L-I-C. And by the way, we have the highest proliferation of gang members on all of MySpace under the umbrella of the Bandana Republic. And they are very excited about it. I mean, it has reached a fever pitch on the streets, or in the streets. And they can't wait to get their hands on the book. And these are people that allegedly society says they don't like to read or they don't want to read. Okay, well, guess what? Now what we're doing is making it sexy for them to read and be readers. You know, when they see that their leaders are a part of something and co-sign something, you know, a head nodded something, then it makes them want to fall into it. And that's why we have to lead by example. So what this book is doing is helping make it that much more palatable to them to want to get involved. So now, instead of bragging about press clippings, about their gang pushing somebody's wig back, now they can brag about the fact that they've been published for the first time and their words are being read all over the world. So we're grateful for that.
Right. So, this is my closing question to all of my guests. And I'll start with you, Louis, and then we'll go to George. Bruce, I'm sorry. If you had 30 seconds in the whole world listening, what would you say?
30 seconds. Our struggle will always be upon us until every single child knows how to read.
And I would say that if I had 30 seconds, or if you have 30 seconds, I would say you better say the most beautiful prayer to be right with your God that you've ever said. You better pray like you've never prayed before, that you can be right with your God and then pray for forgiveness. That's the bottom line. That's coming from me, straight up.
All right. Well, I just want to thank both of you gentlemen for being here,
for bringing such
an enlightened view, a wonderful dialogue, conversation is so necessary. And I do want to let you both know and everyone know, since is a member of the Black Business Space, that he's automatically part of the Black Business Space Value Tour. So we'll be taking the Bandana Republic on tour with us, and our next stop is the L.A. Black Book Expo our next stop, and we're looking for a few more opportunities. So anyone interested in bringing Bruce George or Lewis or any other members to any other contributors,
to your city or to your school or what have you, reach out.
Yeah, for your school, for your event, town hall meetings. So you see, this is a very necessary conversation. So if you'd like to bring that together, it's available. He's not charging a fee, but you do have to cover travel and, you know, stay. You have to cover that expense. So it's an opportunity. Take advantage of it. And I thank you all for listening in. This is Master Griot Radio, a program of the National Black Business Trade Association Radio Live. And as always, we speak for you, peace and love. And we're out.